crackers to the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me do my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leave you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RAMs, SIPs, SIPs. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Welcome, everyone, to Binary Revolution Radio, episode 42. I am Stank Dog, coming to you April 20th, 2004. And joining me again this week for part two of our Google special is our good friend, the Google... Wait a minute, were you the Google Master or the Google Meister? I forgot. I think I was the Google Meister and you're the Google Master. Anyway, Rax, back on the show again. Welcome.
Hello.
And, excuse me, I'm getting a nice drink of my chocolate milk there. And we're going to have a long show again, I predict. So I'm going to jump into some housekeeping. We got some really good email. Probably some of the best email altogether that we've gotten since we started doing the show. And now our first one is... from another real name person. We're going to keep the real name out of it. And this person says, "Hi, I actually found out about BinRev from finding out about port knocking. I noticed on port knocking they mentioned your radio on portknocking.org, he means. They mentioned your radio show. I've been listening and I'm pretty interested in listening to it. Right now I'm on episode 4 and you guys are talking about spam. I just wanted to tell you about mailblocks.com. mailblocks.com. It has a pretty good mechanism for blocking spam. If you care at all, you can check out the basics of it if you want. Anyway, I guess that's all. All right, well, thank you, and welcome to the show. I hope you like it. Obviously, you're going back and listening to some of the old episodes, probably starting with the beginning. So I hope you listen to the newest episodes, too. But
I recommend you listen to them in random order. It makes more sense that way.
Well, it couldn't make any less sense.
There you go.
And actually, it's funny, Rax is the one who actually turned me on and introduced me to port knocking. Oh, man, did I just say Rax is the one who turned me on? They're going to so take that out of context.
Yeah, well, as long as you don't start, like, you and Duel and Land and all, we're talking about all that other nasty junk.
Yeah, well, we won't get too nasty. But turned me on to port knocking is what I was in the middle of saying. And I thought it was just a very unique and unusual and clever idea. It was very creative on how to use something that's been around and been in use for so long, but it was a different way of using it, which, of course, you know, is really what hacking's all about, finding new ways to use things and stuff like that. And we talked about it on a couple of different episodes, actually. I'm sorry?
I think there's also, just saw it on Slashdot today, there's a really cool guy that's into the whole security scene. His name is Ed Skotis. Mm-hmm. There's a link there, book reviews malware fighting malicious code. Anyway, the guy writes a thing about Ed Skotis, and apparently Ed was at DEF CON doing the capture the flag thing too, but I took a look at the book, looks kind of interesting, and he has a section on port knocking in there as well, so he's even making it to the mainstream security books now.
Very cool. Very cool. And we've talked to Martin Kay, or I've communicated with Martin Kay over there a couple times. He even answered some questions for us, and got some information from him, so shouts again to him and to portknocking.org. Go check it out if you haven't. And I hope you enjoy the show and stick around. If you're on episode 4 when you wrote this, I don't know how quickly he can listen to him or getting caught up, but see if he likes the rest or if it goes downhill from episode 4. Who knows? Those are the early episodes with Wintermute, too, so got to touch base with him, and I haven't heard from him in a little while.
Well, it's spring now, so you can't talk to him until winter again.
Yeah, he's got that whole school thing going on. Let's see. Actually, he's out doing the summer vacation thing soon.
Isn't he going to get to go to, like, an engineering camp or something?
He did go to the engineering camp, and it was basically a try it before you buy it school. You know, he's checking out the engineering
I think he was checking out some chick that was going to go there, so last I heard, but anyway.
Wherever the chicks go, so goes Wintermute.
Yeah.
All right, second email we got was from...
Wasn't it Wintermute that said he's only here for the chicks? I think it was, yeah.
I thought it was you. Weren't you the originator of that?
Oh, okay, all right,
yeah,
sorry,
that's
I
right.
got confused.
You, Wintermute, I know how you can get that mixed up. Our second email was from Lochen, L-O-C-H-E-N, says...
I'm glad you spelled that. I thought it would sounded like lotion, so...
Lochen or Loken, I'm not sure. Lochen?
Lochen?
Nah. Like popping and locking? Anyway, Lochen, I'm going to say, says, hello, recently I stumbled upon Wartyping at www.wartyping.com and was wondering exactly what the purpose of Wartyping is. I was wondering if maybe you had any input on the subject of Wartyping. Thanks, Lochen. Well, this is kind of a funny one, Lochen. First of all, Wartyping.com is a site run by our good friend Nick84, and it came about kind of as a joke at first. Early on, I think it was in some of the earlier episodes of InRev Radio, we were talking about... Well, even though it's a joke, it is kind of sound. It does have a sound technical idea behind it. So it's not completely a joke or anything. It's actually viable. But we were discussing one time about... I think it came up because we're talking about universal remote controls and how funny it would be to have a remote control learn your neighbor's TV set and mess with their TV or something like that, the potential for that. And we took it a step further of the same thing with, you know, could you do the same thing with their computer and their keyboard if they had a wireless keyboard or wireless mouse and you had the same brand, for example, or something like that. It'd be funny if you could somehow communicate with their little base station with your wireless mouse, etc. And we talked about, is it possible? Is it technically possible? So Nick84 found it interesting and decided to put that site up a little bit and see what kind of interest there was out there. You can find information on the frequencies used by all the different manufacturers and things like that. And theoretically, the idea of Wartyping, if you want to think of it, the way the term came about was because I said that it was very much related or reminded me of war driving. And if you want a definition of war driving, we go back to war dialing, and we won't go back to that. But basically, reminded me of war driving. War driving, you're driving around trying to find wireless networks, etc.
Hey, you got to give props to Matthew Broderick. That was a cool movie.
Well, what's that, War Games?
War Games, yeah, they're like 82 or something.
Oh, yeah, War Games is like the all-time hacker movie.
Yeah.
All-time hacker movie.
Well, we could do a whole... Maybe that's an episode, a whole episode just about hacking videos and movies, but let's not go there.
Yeah, actually, I have a text file that it's a spreadsheet I collected all the hacker movies that I could think of, even loosely related hacking movies.
It does it have the Forbin Project?
I would have to go back and check.
Well,
it had some pretty obscure things on there. I got to tell you, I did a lot of research when I was writing it, so I did.
It's not really a true list, unless it has the Forbin Project.
All right. Well, we will check, and if it's not there, we'll add it. It has not been updated in probably a year or more, at least. So it's one of those ongoing articles that will be updated every once in a while.
Anyway,
back to Wartyping here. Now, we were thinking. Basically, if you visualize and kind of picture in your head how funny it would be to be walking around with a wireless keyboard and mouse or a wireless keyboard and a receiver and walking past your neighbor's house and Wartyping. So I made up the word Wartyping just on the spur of the moment during the show, kind of coined the phrase, and then it kind of took off from there just to see if there was any interest. Technically, I think it's completely viable. I think it's absolutely reasonable it could be done. But personally, I never got into a whole lot of research. I'm sure Nick84 knows much more about it than I do. So to me, basically, if you want to say what is the purpose of it or what it's used for, A, it's just for the fun of it to see if it can be done, which is so much about hacking and what hacking is all about. But if you want to put an application and really think of it as remote keystroke logging. If you can intercept someone else's keystrokes or mouse movements and things like that, or at the same time, take over their computer and send a funny message or something. I'm not saying you should do that, but I'm just saying the possibility or the application of it.
Well, you're not actually logging it though necessarily. You're just kind of doing like a man in the middle attack.
Right, but obviously it could easily be logged. You could easily set up logging if you can just collect them.
Right.
You know, or even, you know, if you are just completely intercepting it and visually watching what he's doing or that person is doing on the screen, you can watch the mouse, you can watch the passwords go by, et cetera, et cetera.
I just like that picture of just, you know, someone walking down the street with, you know, just a keyboard in their hand. I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got the monitor strapped to his forehead. Anyway.
Or even funnier would be walking down the middle of New York City without a monitor, just the keyboard and the wireless.
The keyboard and wireless, and you have like your glasses and make it look like one of those little, you know, like the little implant board kind of thing or whatever.
Yeah, just pretend there's a big monitor in front of it.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, that's it. That's all there is to word typing. It's nothing phenomenal, and it's nothing that people have really done a whole lot of research or found a whole lot of data on, other than, like I said, our friend Nick84, who found it interesting. So, yeah, check out wordtyping.com if you are interested in it. And I don't know if he's... I know he's been busy with a lot of other projects as well as school, so I don't know that he's been doing a whole lot of updates to that site, frankly. So, or even if it's still around, to be honest with you. I don't know if he ever renewed the site when it came up for renewal. Can you you have a live internet connection there, right?
Yeah, I got to it.
It is still there?
Yeah.
Okay, good deal.
So you just apparently indicated you have a dead internet connection.
Yeah, thanks to our good friends at Comcast, my wonderful cable modem, which I've been raving about how great it was until it goes down. That's when it... Ugh.
Well, you know, nice computers never go down.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a nice computer, apparently. I have a bad girl computer. She goes down a lot.
Yeah.
All right. Email number 3. Again, I feel like David Letterman all of a sudden. This email's really, really cool. This came from someone, real name withheld, we're not going to mention, but... it said, and this one's kind of long, so bear with me here. It says, "Hi there, Stank Dog. Greets all the way from South Africa. Yes, we do have internet down here." Wow, that immediately I was like, wow, South Africa? How cool is that?
So apartheid goes away, then they get the internet. Look at that.
Yep. "I have been listening to your show along with RFA." Have you heard of this RFA I keep hearing about, Rax? What is that? RFA?
I don't know. Rash-free America, something
yes,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think it's like a Department of Health thing.
Yeah.
"I've been listening to your show along with RFA, although I'm abusing the archive section seriously at the moment. Streaming is not an option as our international bandwidth is not that constant unless you have ADSL. I only caught on to RFA late in December 2003 and heard about your own show through Duel. I would just like to send you a note of appreciation. I am learning so much through your shows. In fact, I am a Nopix convert." How about that? "I have been running successfully for a couple of months now, and Windows is now a mere distant nightmare that I never wish to see again." Well, I never wish to see it again either, but, you know, sometimes I'm stuck with it. "You are responsible for opening my eyes and the possibility of not using Windows. I would like to buy you a beer sometime." Very cool. "Here's a suggestion for your show. Use it, don't use it. How about a newbie slot, say 5 minutes sometime during the show where a topic would be discussed very briefly? Some examples: Linux file system types, advantages and disadvantages of each, kernel compilation basic steps, how an MBR, master boot record, works, the OSI layer, nothing in depth, just to give us newbies some background info on our PCs, just enough to spark interest in getting some detailed how-tos or docs on the subject. Being so new to Linux and PCs in general, there is so much to learn. It is more a case of, well, what do I feel like learning next? I have been terrified about compiling my own kernel since installing Nopix and found out what a kernel was. I have Googled some detailed docs now and am busy compiling as we speak. Although it's seriously flawed, but if I don't try, I'll never understand." Well, amen to that. "I used to be a hardcore gamer, and as far as understanding PCs, well, all I delved into was getting the most frames per second, FPS, frames per second, out of my system to run a specific game. After a couple of years, games no longer held the interest they used to, and in the search for something new, along came radio shows that offered help, insight, and thirst for understanding and knowledge. Anyways, keep up the good work. The show goes from strength to strength. All the best in everything you do."
That's cool.
Thank you so much for that letter. That was one of the coolest. I mean, South Africa, holy crap. That's a long-distance listener right there, man. Amazing. An amazing distance. Holy cow. Anyway, you're welcome to abuse the archives, first of all. That's what they're there for. We pay for the extra bandwidth so that people can download the show. We want you to. So by all means, hit the archives up as much as you want.
Here's a technical technical note too, even if you're streaming to listen to it, you still have to get all the same number of bits. So it's whether you start to download them and you get to hear it, or you have to spend X amount of time downloading it and getting it to your computer. You're still using the same amount of bandwidth. So consider that the newbie tip of the week.
Yeah, technically it's the exact same number, except that you can actually, since he inferred anyway, he said he doesn't have DSL, so I infer that he means he's on dial-up. And if you go to rantradio.com, they have a low bitrate version that's even smaller. So it actually encodes down to a smaller bitrate so that people on dial-up modems might be able to listen to the stream live. So you might give that a shot. But he was saying that it wasn't a good constant. I think he used the word constant. Our bandwidth is not that constant. So it may be a consistency issue where it's not, you know, it can't maintain a connection for long periods of time or something along those lines. But anyway, yes, that's definitely an option. And I hope he can get, I don't know how if he's going to have enough bandwidth to download Hack TV. We are going to work out something where people can order it on CD or something like that. We'll work the logistics of that out soon.
Speaking of which, that came out last week.
Yes, it did, and I was going to touch on that a little bit later on, so
yeah,
why don't we
let's
hold
we'll save it then.
Yeah, we'll hold off just a little bit. I wasn't going to go into too much detail, but yeah, we'll touch on that a little bit later. And let's see. Oh, Dual Parallel, of course, from RFA. Of course, I was joking, Radio Freak America, a show that you and I were both on at some point in time. You're like one of the founding members, like the founding cast members of SNL. Is that?
Yeah,
you're
we found it in a back alley when we were doing some dumpster diving and brought it back to life.
So. Yeah. So, yeah, Dual Parallel, good friend of ours. He's been on the show before and hopefully sometime soon, too. And he's been great. I hope he does... I hope I did as well on the show as he's done on Ben Rev Radio. So, as I'm sure, assume he's heard by now, RFA ended with episode 99, which we're sad about, but Duel has some ideas for some upcoming projects. So, and both he and Bland are both going to be ecstatic that they converted someone to Nopix. So they're going to be dancing a jig of joy for that one.
Okay, but who's the one who turned those dudes on to Nopix?
Who would be the one that turned them on to Nopix?
That would be I.
Would that be a pat on the back?
Yeah.
All right. Well, then I guess you inadvertently turned me on to Nopix, too. So, thank you.
But you turned me on, I turned you on. It sounded really
good.
Oh,
man,
okay.
Man, take this stuff out of context. You're just really...
Dude, you're going to have to mix in some of that, you know, funky 70s jazz kind of bounce, chicka bow bow.
Bounce, chicka bow bow. Wicka, 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 bounce, chicka bow wow. All right. Let's see. Back to the email here. God, we're so horrible about going off.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
At least we have
Your suggestions were great about the newbie section, but they're just not quite as easy as you would think, especially in 5 minutes, to portray these kind of topics anywhere, and most especially on a radio show.
However, we try to
do some of this when we can. We try to do some hands-on topics, and even later on today, I'm going to talk about, along with our Google stuff, I was going to talk about some fun things that people can try with Google Answers and stuff like that.
However, doesn't Ben Rev, the magazine, actually kind of cater towards the newbie?
Right, and that's exactly what I was, leading into, is that it's more of a visual... in written form to teach somebody the detail level of things. And radio's not the best medium for that, in my opinion anyway. I mean, we can do certain things, but it's hard to back up and rewind and listen to see what did he say and step by step and things like that. It makes it really tough. So I'll try to put some more of this into the show, and we always try to put a little bit of play-at-home kind of stuff. But I really think it's much better to have something written articles, Binary Revolution magazine, as you were just saying, or any of the online zines or magazines, websites. All of our old articles are up at stankdog.com, most of them for download. And, you know, personally, I'm very visual. I like to include screenshots, stuff like that. I like to include more, enough information to make people see and understand and follow it step by step. And it lets you back up and reread it if you have to, or stop in the middle of it and pick it up later and not lose your train of thought so much. Or use it as a reference, you know, pick the magazine back up later if you're trying to remember something or look something back up. And I think that's great, and that's exactly what the written medium is for. Different mediums have different uses and applications, and some better than others. Another possibility, and again, comes back to what you just mentioned, is being that this is something I consider a visual, this might be a great thing to put on Hack TV.
There you go.
There are some things that you can show first person, and we've talked about that, and we've had some ideas. We didn't include them in episode one, but definitely in some upcoming ones where we have some follow along the screen kind of, you know, showing the video of what we're doing as we go along. You see the keystrokes as we talk over it. So some of that lends itself, that type of, that medium, the video medium lends itself better to something like that as well. So I will try to include more stuff on here, and I'm not sure how well it's going to go, but we'll do what we can. So thank you very much for the email. Next time I'm in South Africa, I'm coming by for a beer, man, so be ready. Okay, that's probably not going to happen ever because
yeah,
I've never really been to South Africa. And anyway, but I have a free beer waiting for me. So send us some pictures, by the way. Send us some cool pictures of what you got down there, some technology, some computers, some phones, stuff like that. Like to see the differences. Now, we have one more email. We're still in the freaking housekeeping section. Got one more email here, but this one is going to segue us into Google because this is a response from our episode 41 last week. And this one is from Crate, K-R-A-Y-T, Crate. On the show, you talked about Google doing Gmail, and as far as the legal pages and all, they are pretty good. Standard cover their posterior tactics, and we reserve the right to reject sort of stuff. As far as the storage issue, you are talking about likely the largest search system in history. All they really have to do to save a bit of space, is a simple compression system based on searching and linking. When I was around 11, I thought about basic compression, and now I can see how it easily applies here. Think about what constitute the majority of the bulk on email systems. For the average user, it's not the attachments alone, it's the newsletters and the jokes and the anecdotes that are carbon copy to everyone in Grandma Sue's address book. To compress it down, all you really have to do is find large, similar parts on many emails, the entirety of FRAC, for example, and link into the system. That the body of the message is stored in a shared location. The headers would be different, but that is a tiny amount compared to the body in this case. Much of the bulk email could be compressed in this manner, and really the headers would just be dynamic and based upon each individual account. If 500 people get the same 50K message, then that would normally be around 25,000K or over 24 meg. If you simply stored the headers for each account and the message in a shared location, you can have 500 people with 50K used and only really store around 1 megabyte, ultimately on the system, probably even less. 23 megabyte may not seem like a significant savings, but in terms of Google's usage, on the scale that this could take, that would be quite considerable, and that is just one message. For the unique messages, it could be as little as 3 to 8 meg at first, likely less per person. As storage solutions advance, it will get considerably less difficult to attain. By the time many people start using a larger amount, that larger amount will likely be perfectly feasible. In short, they look to me to be banking on tech advances and perhaps are waiting to go ahead with the public use until it is assured that it will be plausible that this will be an adequate money-making venture. Trust me, they're going to make their money. Until it is ready, I will continue using others that are adequate for my purposes. Hotbox.ru, for example. Yay for 40 megabytes, IMAP, POP3, and forwarding. All right. A lot of good suggestions, a lot of good ideas in that. I have a couple follow-ups, unless you wanted to jump into this one.
Well, regarding the compression, it's kind of an interesting aspect of it, but cross-linking between all the people, so Grandma Sue forwards it off to 40 people, maybe only one of those people is using a Gmail account, they're going to do compression, which is very likely, and again, you would get very high compression ratios. They'll probably just compress either, probably not the individual messages, but they may do, like your directories at a time of messages for each account or something, but I never thought about that, but yeah, very likely they will use compression to help, squeeze every bit of things out.
Right.
And Google may be doing that even now with their own kind of compression algorithms with their cached pieces of information because that would be taking up a lot of space, so they could theoretically I'm sure they have tons of memory, so they could have it all compressed and have their compression algorithm actually search their search algorithm actually go through the compressed file with without having to uncompress it. Just do it in memory.
Yeah, that's actually one of the points I wanted to mention about this. It is definitely, you know, they're going to have to use some sort of compression. It's a great point, absolutely. But I'm not... Okay, first of all, the majority of this is raw ASCII text, which we know compresses phenomenally, a lot. And most local email clients, you can compress your local folders and stuff like that, save a lot of space. But there's a big difference between compressing your local client, your local email that's used by one or just a couple people on your local email client, and using such a large scale of Google where you've got potentially millions of users accessing it. Compression and decompression is fairly CPU intensive. So obviously they're going to have some power to be able to do this. So I'm not sure, you know, he even said in his email this would be one of the largest storage systems ever. I don't even know how to ballpark a guess of how many people would be hitting it. A million at a time? 2 million hitting the site at any given time, reading through their email?
Well, let's get back to the compression aspect of it now, and the CPU and what have you. First of all, if I remember correctly, I think Google is using basically, you know, like white box clones, basic clustered together with FreeBSD. I believe that's their primary setup. So they can cluster and have huge amounts of systems, and then, you know, so then they have you know, teraflops of data, I don't know, of CPU available to them. So I don't know if it's you've never heard anything released about, you know, how many teraflops worth of, you know, quasi supercomputing power Google has. But the again, if you're writing your own systems and you have your own search algorithms, you could do your own compression that's optimized for that environment. So as opposed to using like a gzip or, you know, the .zip file in Windows type of thing, as opposed to using one of those, they could be using this is more for like encryption, but they could be using like a streaming compression versus a block compression. So they could, you know relatively easily stream that and decompress the things on the fly and search through those in memory and all that. So, you know, they've got some very, very smart people there and some very good programmers. So,
oh, I'm sure.
I'm sure they've looked into all those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure they have. And, you know, compressing your files that are stored, you know, is most likely a nightly batch job that goes through and, you know, compresses hard drives at a time or entire accounts of your old messages or something like that, something that you're not going to access as frequently. So from a batch standpoint, that's definitely not a problem. It's definitely a good way to go. But doing it on the fly, like you said, I'm sure they've got something, but I question a little bit how, if it's as much as we suspect or that exact way that we suspect. And actually, funny you mentioned about the computing power. I still have taped right here in front of my, right in front of my face, taped to my monitor, a list of the 10 most powerful supercomputers in the world. We did this on a show a long time back where I listed these. And number 4 is Linux Networks, the MCR Linux cluster, Lawrence Liverpool National Laboratory, 5.694 teraflops per second, excuse me. So clustering is potentially gives a phenomenal amount of power.
There's also a link, speaking of which, and we'll come back to Google just in a second, but there's a interesting distributed project site. It's md5crk.com. md5 as in message digest, as in hashing algorithm. And the whole purpose of this is basically to show that, you know, MD5 shouldn't be used anymore because there's enough power to deal with it. But and so instead of having a client like you had for the SETI at home project or any of the other things, there's just a Java applet that runs when you go to the various sites. And this was dated back March 15th, which was just actually a couple of days before they were slashdotted, or just a couple of days after they were slashdotted. The distributed project of everyone doing this for the MD5 crack, they said at that time, about a month ago, just passed the 412 gigaflops. By some definitions of a supercomputer, would place it in the top 500.
Hmm. Yeah, and, you know, we have the distributed.NET client, this distributed.NET project that we run there at benrev.com that you can look into, and I would be interested to see where they rank, because I bet they're even larger.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah, so that's probably a phenomenal amount of power, too. But you know what? To tie this back into Google, I don't know if you've noticed or if you even use this, but Google Toolbar, one of the new features they've added to the Google Toolbar, which is a Java plugin toolbar to Internet Explorer, has a distributed project on it. I haven't had time to look in to see exactly which one it is. But as the toolbar is active, as your Internet Explorer is active, you can have it take over your idle CPU time, just like distributed client and stuff like that, and take over your CPU time and run in the browser and send that information back. I don't know which distributed project they're using, but I do know they've added that to the toolbar within probably the past month or two, a couple months anyway.
Maybe that's how they're going to be doing all the compression stuff, that they're going to use the distributed horsepower that everybody else
is. How ironic would that be? They use your own power to compress and filter and search through your own mail.
There you go.
Hey, dude, you know what? That's pretty elite.
Interested, the top 500 supercomputer. It's top500.org.
That's definitely. I'm going to have to check that one out tomorrow.
So when you get your Comcast back up.
Well, yeah, I'll stick around late and do it for more. You know what? This is probably going to end up being streamed from. Somewhere else. I caught myself. So this is going to be streamed from somewhere else, obviously, or hopefully maybe by someone else. See, I can't even send it to you to ask you to stream it or Duel or something because I don't have any internet connection.
Right, right.
I can overnight it.
The dog pound. It'll from some other compound.
Yeah. Anyway, back to Google. There's one other flaw here. There's one other thing. Not necessarily a flaw, but something that has to be programmed around, and again, maybe they've already done it. And that was, he referred to those commonly forwarded jokes and stories, et cetera, that they're all the same joke. But even though they're all the same joke, same thing forwarded around, they are all different emails. And what I mean to say is that each one of these people who forwarded on to their others add their own little comment at the top. Hey, Grandma, look at this. You know, stuff like that at the top of it. So they're not all identical.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think it's actually, even though it's an interesting concept, I think it's actually impractical to be compressing the whole message, you know, and have it shared amongst multiple people. Because let's face it, there's going to be 100 million people on Gmail, you know, there's probably 900 million people out there that have email that's not on Gmail. So.
Right. Right. Well, as long as it picks it up from whatever source, Google, wherever they hold it. I don't think that would be too much of a problem.
Yeah, but I've got my several of my own domains, and I have email there, right?
Right.
Let alone my Gmail account. You know, if I get it. So if I send a copy of the message to my three different email servers, and it's not on Gmail, Gmail has, and, you know, so I have one copy's on Gmail and one copy's on Hushmail, and you know, there's copies other places. There's no way that Gmail has access to that, so there's no way they can compress that across messages on different systems.
Well, no. I'm sure he's referring to only on the Gmail system to other Gmail users or from, you know, if they have a Gmail account.
Right, but again, what I'm saying is I think the likelihood of that happening is going to be small, even though there'll be a lot of stuff there. They're not going to have a Microsoft market share in email, okay? They're not going to have 95% of the people in the world
using email.
Are not going to be using Gmail. So I think that's kind of it's an interesting thought, I think it's kind of a moot point because I don't think there'd be enough copies of that on Gmail necessarily to make it worthwhile trying to compress it between user accounts. The user accounts themselves being compressed, yes, absolutely. But across user accounts, I highly doubt it.
I don't know. I think you might be surprised at that. I think there may be enough copies across there to make it worthwhile to do that. Obviously, they'd have to be very careful.
But again,
how they programmed it, and when you went to forward it somewhere else, I'm picturing it in my mind as like an include statement. You include, you have your thing that says, hey, Grandma, look at this. They're going to be searching your email. That's established as far as the advertising part of it. That is established, so they're going to be searching through it anyway. If they do find a common forwarded joke, there's no reason they can't cut that and put a link or an include statement to pull it from one location instead of keeping it intact. Keep your little, hi, Grandma, look what I found, then a pound include.
Do you realize how complex it would be to do that?
Oh, I didn't say it would be easy.
Statistically, the likelihood of that happening? Well, okay, what about when I forward it, and I'm one of those stupid end users, when I forward something, I put a whole other set of greater than signs on the front of the line, and then someone else forwarded it, so your copy has nothing, right?
Right.
Me, I forwarded someone else, and it has one set. They forwarded someone that has two sets. You're not going to be break that down on a line to line.
Well, it's also not going to be all-inclusive. It's not going to be 100% perfect and catch them all, and I was getting ready to say that even though this is something that's commonly forwarded, everybody adds a little touch at the top. Also, not only that, they in turn forward it to someone else, so in turn forwards it to someone else. You've got indentations in there. You've got those little carrots in there, greater than signs.
But that's why sometimes I'm saying it'll be impractical to do that across messages because if,
Impractical, I don't know. I think it's possible. I don't know if
certainly
it's...
Certainly possible, but it's...
I don't know how impractical. I'd have to try it and see it. I don't know if I'm that skeptical. I think it actually could work.
It certainly could work technically, but I'm virtually certain that the probability of having that, to doing it, to make it worth the return of the investment of programming and everything else, you know, talk about your CPU overhead. Okay, so now I'm going to have to parse out greater than signs and do... I still say it's impractical to do that across accounts.
Right. Well, like I said, some of the ones, it's not going to be able to parse through greater than signs the same for everybody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not going to be 100% effective. But it depending on how many users they got, if they get millions of users like Hotmail, if they get millions of users like Yahoo, I do think that in the long run it will be worth the time and save some space.
Well, I think we'll have to agree to disagree on that.
All right, well, we'll see. Someday maybe they'll actually release some information, but I doubt it. But, yeah, I actually do think that that's not it's not going to be perfect, and it's not going to be a dramatic change, but I do think it's a worthy change. I really do think it's worth looking into. But again, you know, like the point that you're making is absolutely valid. You know, people forward it, not only the carrots and stuff like that, but those people that I hate that you have to go through two pages of to and from headers that they don't strip out the previous headers as they forward it to. And that really annoys me, and that's going to be difficult to parse out. So it sounds like a great idea for everybody to see the same email, store it on their server, and you just, you know, everybody sees the same one, but you can't, Google can't, excuse me, or shouldn't, I shouldn't say can't. They shouldn't go through the email and strip out anything.
Right, and then...
You know, because there's the danger of stripping out the... You know, you could have a valley. It's not necessarily, hey, Grandma, look at this. It could be, hey, Grandma, I haven't talked to you in a while. I'm going to be going in for that operation next weekend, but I thought I'd send you this joke to cheer you up before I go. I'll be fine. Talk to you later. You're not going to strip something like that. There's a valid message in there. So you've got to be careful when you're parsing through something like that you don't strip out valid information.
That's why I'm saying it's impractical. But let's actually brings up another aspect.
But I think that's an exception. That's an exception to the rule, I think.
Well, again, we'll have to agree to disagree. But that brings about another aspect of it. And let's assume, for once in your life, I mean, let's assume that you're correct on this, and they will be doing that. Now, just think about the privacy implications. So, any three-lettered governmental agency can say, okay, Gmail, you know, give me everyone who received this particular email, because, you know, that came from a suspected terrorist. Now all those people who received it and have it stored on Gmail are a potential terrorist. Privacy.
Well, that's the whole thing we're going to talk about as soon as we finish this email. We're not done yet.
Oh, sorry.
We're still going with this, because that's what I'm saying. This is actually a really good segue into our main topic. So I saved this for last. But I tell you this, let me see what you think about this as far as agree to disagree. How about this? On an individual scale, if that particular email was forwarded to five people that's exactly the same, if I forward it to your Gmail account, Duel's Gmail account, my mom's Gmail account, Bland's Gmail account, and I don't know, Cy Pete's Gmail account, that is an identical message. And you can identify that identical message because there is a code or a, quote, message ID.
Every
message is one unique message, and then it's delivered or given access to those five people that I gave you for an example.
Right.
So it is stored in one place in that location. That's the nature of it.
Except for the message header, everything else would be unique. Yeah.
Exactly. So that is where space is going to be saved. It actually only exists in one location.
Right, but my point is, I think the likelihood of that will be so remote as to make it not worth the investment of developing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, see, I guess without either one of us being in the middle of it, I mean, again, I'm picturing, and his, and I'll close it out like this. His point is DOB accurate. Don't ask me what that means. It's dead on point accurate. And that is scale. This is such an enormous scale, you know, that even if accounts start off small, 3 to 8 megs, like you said, they're going to grow immensely over time. The number of users is going to grow. It remains to see whether or not they're even going to be able to handle all this and how they handle it all. So the scale on this, I think when you start talking about millions of users and terabytes upon terabytes of space, if you can save a gig here and there, I absolutely think it's worthwhile. And I do think it'll add up to gigs. But, again, that's an opinion thing, and we can agree to disagree on that. But one other thing, thank you for mentioning an alternative webmail source, hotbox.ru. There's another one if you're interested to go check that one out.
Well, there's another one, too, I've used before, although it's been a little bit slow. It's inbox.lv in Latvia. And one I'm using that I had mentioned is actually kind of cool because it's doing encryption. It's called Hushmail, Hushmail. They do 2048-bit SSL encryption, but it's a it's free for a month, but then it's like $30 or $40 a year or something. So you can get me at racks@hushmail.com, too, if you want to.
Yeah, there are lots and lots of other alternatives out there.
And, hey, I think I'm going to do something really bad here for radio, but I got to go shut my front door, so I'll be right back.
All right. Well, while you do that, I will do a quick step through the show and tell, the personal stuff, what we've been working on. And obviously, it's been the release of Hack TV. Hack TV came out last week on the 15th, so hopefully everybody's gone and downloaded that and watched it. And we're not going to go into any detail on it right now. We've gotten some feedback, but I think we're going to wait and talk about it next week or the week after, give it a little time to get out there. So really, that's what all my focus has been on for the past week or so. And we'll talk about it more again. Hopefully, if I can try to get Saito on the show, and we'll talk about some things soon.
And the other thing, too, about that is, we should get a few of the crew that has it and has some high-speed stuff to start a BitTorrent of it. So that'll help the distribution efforts.
Yeah, we have a BitTorrent up for it.
Okay, cool. Grab it that way, too.
It helped phenomenally. It really did help a lot. And we had, our users were so great. I looked at any given point, we had like 16 or 17 people open and seeding the file. In addition to myself, of course, the main seed was on my server. And see, this is what, oh, damn you, you pushed me onto the soapbox. Damn you. All right, damn it. Ugh. All right, fine, I'm on it now. See, this is why it really pisses me off when these people go out there and talk about how bad BitTorrent is and how bad these peer-to-peer, because all they do is share piracy. Guess what? I'm darn thankful, and I'm holding my language as best I can. I am doggone thankful that we had an option like that. That saves my bandwidth so much, applications like this. This is a perfect example of how these kind of applications can be damn useful. Don't go out there and throw out the baby with the bathwater. Okay, there's some piracy that goes on. I'm not naive. I know that happens. I've seen it. I know what's up with that. But guess what? I have a viable reason to use that, and this damn RAA and MPAA and all these government people want to shut stuff like this down, saying, oh, it can be used for piracy. Well, guess what? That's the stupidest argument I've ever heard in my freaking life.
Well, you know what? An airplane can be used as a bomb, too. So you going to make those illegal?
We went into that a little bit last week, so I just had to get that off my chest. That pisses me off when I hear that kind of stuff.
Okay, take a downer.
I am. I'm cool. I'm chilling. Let me get some chocolate milk.
I bet you use that powdered kind of chocolate milk.
Like, oh, no.
Quick or something.
No. Well, when I was a kid, we had to use that because it was cheaper, but, using the good stuff now. I'm moving on up. All right, that's my singing for the show. That's all you get. Have a great outtake of you singing. We'll have to save that for a special episode. Unless you had something specific you want to bring up, I thought now we'll push you back on the soapbox and we'll talk about the privacy aspects of Gmail. We're done with the housekeeping, we're done with the show and tell, move right into the show topic, so got 10 more minutes left in the show.
Hey, well, getting back to, I forget where we left off from last week, but...
I think the best thing to start is right where you were going, and that is the privacy implications. We touched on it last week, but we didn't go into detail and put some scenarios out there, and I think that would be something that you can do, and I think that's something that you have been wanting to do, if I'm not correct. If I am correct.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Again, I mentioned it last week, and if you haven't checked it out, and if you're interested in seeing what Google's about, go to google-watch.org. Google-watch.org. And they also have an Amazon Watch and a Yahoo Watch. So, remember, knowledge is power, information is power. Anytime someone can gather up information about you and what you're doing and your habits, that's useful to someone. That's salable information. Now, why do you think all those spyware programs exist? Is to gather up your habits. So now with Google, and then they talk about, Google's evil cookie, it doesn't expire until, 30 years from now or something like that. So theoretically, just tons and tons and tons of things there. And there's even a link out there, Gmail, be careful. And they talk about some of the things in there. We'll maybe touch on that in a minute. But say that, but...
Right.
So here's the thing. You've got all that kind of information there. And as you are browsing... Now, and I even admitted last week when I use Google, and if I don't go through, like, Google Watch's anonymous proxy, because it's not as convenient as having it there. I use Firefox, and there's a little bar right up in there for having it searched through Google. So it's very convenient, and it's quite good. And I'll have to admit, having the advertisements there, sometimes if I'm looking for a commercial product or something, sometimes having the advertisement there is very handy. But when you start, even though there's no personally identifiable information, right? They don't know who you are and that. They certainly do know your IP address, and as we all know, if need be, if any three-lettered governmental agency or law enforcement agency, which is actually is an LEA, so I guess they're a three-lettered agency as well, but if someone in quote-unquote authority wants to find out, it can be tracked back. Heck, you can even get, you notice how I kept it nice and clean there, rated PG.
Yes, you did.
The RIAA and the MPAA, how do you think they're finding out who these people are? They're tracing back from those IP addresses. They're using things with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Of course, there's the USAPA or the US Patriot Act, and I don't want to call it just the Patriot Act because that's buying into their marketing. The Patriot Act has nothing to do with being patriotic, okay? It's a huge acronym. US doesn't even stand for United States, okay, in the USA Patriot Act. So that information can be delved down. It can be drilled down into. They can contact your ISP and find out who had that IP address at that particular time. So now, as you're doing that type of thing, even though, quote-unquote, no personally identifiable information is being gathered, yes, there is some type of thing that can be found. Now, all the searches you go, so if I'm searching, for, and I think you used this example last week, Stank, was, if I'm searching for fertilizer and diesel fuel, that could trigger an alarm somewhere. Now, maybe I'm a farmer who, needs to buy diesel fuel for my manure spreader because I got to fertilize the fields. But I can also, again, it all comes back down to intent, I can use diesel fuel and fertilizer to make a bomb, a.k.a. the Oklahoma City bombings, right?
All right.
So the types of things you're searching for can now be used against you. And specifically with Gmail, you have to be concerned because they are targeting ads to you, and aside from the fact, and I'll, like, as I even admitted, I sometimes find them useful. And even though there may not be any human watching that, and of course it wouldn't pay to have a human being sitting there reading your email and then telling what ads to get, it wouldn't be practical, it wouldn't be, any of that type of thing. So the program is doing that automatically for you. But again, that still could be monitored if someone had a reason to, again, think three-letter agency. And there's just so many of those things, even as we were touching on earlier, the idea of linking those emails together. So, someone sends a surreptitious email out to a suspected terrorist who forwards it on to everybody. Now I'm searching through or having, I subpoena Google to search through their Gmail to see everyone who's received that. Now I've identified these people, and I can start using that and tracing that back to get them.
And God forbid there's a technical snafu that causes you to see an email that you weren't intended to on accident. Like, remember, I think you might have been on the show. I mentioned a while back that I got medical records from some doctor with the same name as me. That wasn't intended for me. And don't flag me. This is your favorite phrase lately, but these three-letter agencies, don't flag me for getting some email. I didn't ask for that. I didn't know what it was. It was sent to me, accidentally. There's so many,
And who would imagine there's a doctor somewhere named Doctor, first name Stank, last name Dog. It's just amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
Really gets me. But, so the privacy issue is just incredibly huge. So when they talk about tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorists, I try not to be, but I try to be a realist, and I try to think about what they're doing and potentially what they could do. And again, the whole idea of technology has a dark side. Any company that's selling technology is going to tell you about the benefits to you. They won't talk about the potential negative impacts of those things. They won't talk about the fact it could be, it could be held against you. Anything you say could be held against you, type of thing. So they're not going to be talking about that. They're going to be selling you on the upside of things. So we need people to actually have a healthy amount of skepticism. You have to think about, okay, well, gee, those RFID tags, that's really cool technology, and it'll help the It'll help the companies out because they can track and they can prevent, you know, shoplifting, and that'll make, you know, that'll keep the cost down for me as a consumer. Gee, golly, gosh, darn, gee, isn't that great?
Well, they already have anti-pirate. They already have those little metallic things.
Yeah, but those are expensive. Like the stuff where, you know, it has the exploding ink on clothes and that. But when you get into that, so that's the Pollyanna view of technology. Is that, gee, isn't this great? You know, we live in such a wonderful time. It has all these things. And I'll admit, yeah, there are good sides to it. But again, I maintain that you need that healthy level of skepticism to say, wait a minute, what about, how do, you know, example, the RFID tags, how do we know they're turned off? How could that be used against us? And a lot of people are talking about those scenarios. And if, again, knowledge is power, we need to be informed and we need to think about those other things. The whole other thing about the dark side of technology,
as it relates to Google.
Technology classes and security classes and networking classes. The Internet is a cooperative anarchy. The Internet was designed in TCP/IP protocols and everything else. Most of the applications we're using now were designed back in times when everyone trusted everybody. TCP/IP, the protocol itself, is vastly insecure. There's all kinds of problems with it. So that's why there's IPsec, which is a bear to implement and everything else. But, you know, trying to pull it back in here. So
yeah.
You have to have a healthy level of skepticism about things. You have to think about how could this be used against me. And that's all I'm encouraging people to do. And I think there's a lot of people out there now. There's technically savvy people who are looking at this. And certainly if you go to any of your 2600 meetings, and if you go to the DEF CON meetings, and if you listen to some of these shows on Rant Radio and read, you know, BinRev Magazine and a lot of Frack and everything else out there, why do you think people are talking about that? It's just to bring that to light, because let's face it, folks, when it comes, I'm going to sound like meme here in a second, but you know, we're such sheep when it comes to the consumer-oriented society we have. We're just taking everything hook, line, and sinker. So Gmail sounds great. There's a lot of cool aspects to it. And we were talking about this two meetings ago when it was first announced. Actually, it was announced April 1st, so at our April 2nd, I guess it was last meeting, at our local 2600/DEF CON meeting here in Phoenix, we were talking about that and talking about some of the ways, you know, that people will start to think about working around things. And I think we talked about it too last week. Stank was, you know, like attachments, and you know, so I could use that as a file repository and stuff. And we talked on the show here last week about some of the steps that could be taken. But privacy issues are incredibly huge, incredibly huge. Yeah. Do you want someone else out there to be able to read your information? It's bad enough, you know, being stored in your hard drive at home. You don't know if some three-letter agency has gotten a court order to come into your house, open up your computer, clone your hard drive, and take it back for analysis. Because, yes, folks, that does happen. So it's bad enough when it's in your own home, but when it's off someplace else, that makes me very, very concerned. That's why one of my external mail accounts that I do really do anything with is that Hushmail, because it's 2048-bit encrypted. And yes, you can break that encryption, but it's much more difficult than just decompressing a file in Gmail.
Right, absolutely. Now, actually, if I can interject just a little bit, just to make sure that we didn't leave anybody with a couple of the terms that you use, I thought I'd come back to PII, Personally Identifiable Information. Now, I can tell you, I've studied this in my law classes. From a legal standpoint, this is a very, very important term and a very important word. Personally identifiable information is what they use to judge and decide when privacy has been violated, what constitutes personally identifiable information. And it is something that, as it implies, personally identifies a person. It's something unique, a name, address, social security number, phone numbers, things like that, that can personally identify someone as a unique individual. So this is very important, that this, of all things, above all else, that your personally identifiable information, or PII, which is commonly referred to for obvious reasons, is protected. Now, Google claims that to be the case. They're not denying otherwise, outwardly. But the potential exists is one thing, you know, to keep in mind with this. Secondly, they are going to, I guess, I'm not even sure how to put this into words. They're going to deliver targeted content to you.
Advertisements, in other words.
Right. Targeted content to you based on your interests, etc. And they're going to deliver that to you in some way. And this is probably a bad segue. What I'm getting at is, and frankly, I know that you'll talk for 3 hours on this, so this is going to be a rhetorical question. Frankly, there's a very, very open-ended debate that could take place and discussion on what constitutes personally identifiable information. Does a person's IP address at a given single point in time constitute personally identifiable information?
I'll answer it in a word, yes.
Yes.
Now the RIAA and MPAA are bringing these lawsuits against people.
Right. So, legally, I don't believe that's ever been challenged in a court of law in a legal system, and that's one of the things that's also that's being kicked around because of all these lawsuits, as you said, is that definition. Are they necessarily doing morally? Yes, in my opinion, of course. Morally, and everybody has that decision to make. Morally, it's implorable to me what they're doing. But legally, which is the important thing in this country, as much as you hate to admit it, legally, are they doing anything wrong? Are they messing, or are they infringing on anyone's PII? And that is the big question at hand. So I just wanted to explain PII and how important that piece is to the whole equation. Not only with Google and Gmail, but in general, PII is a very important word for you to know. Your privacy hinges around what the legal system defines as your personally identifiable information.
And by the way, for all the listeners out there in the U.S., we know we're listening.
Yeah, I apologize. Of course, this refers mostly to the United States.
Right. But the extra thing I was going to throw in here, speaking of personally identifiable information, your Social Security number is being used, potentially is being used by all kinds of companies and everything else to identify you. Look at your driver's license. If your driver's license number equals your Social Security number, I want you to contact your Department of Motor Vehicles or Motor Vehicle Division or whatever it's called in your state and request another driver's license. It's going to cost you a couple of bucks, but do it, because think about it. Anytime anyone asks for, let me talk about the driver's license thing again. If you go to buy something with a check somewhere and they want some ID, so they write down your driver's license number. They have your name, your address, your phone number, your driver's license number, and your bank account. Now, the company that you're buying the thing from may not do anything about that, but think about that minimum wage slave that's taking all that information. If your driver's license number equals your Social Security number, they have just about everything they need to impersonate you and steal your identity. Why do you think identity theft is such a huge issue? So virtually anything other than like a bank or your employer that wants to use your Social Security number for your ID number, say, no thank you, I want you to give me another number. Now, it's less convenient for you. It's much more convenient if you just use that one number to identify yourself everywhere. But let's face it, folks, it's much more convenient to you if you use the same password everywhere, which we all know is not a good idea. So if you're out there and your Social Security number is being used as any other kind of ID for anything else, heck, even like these prometric testing things, that they want to use your Social Security number as your identifying number when you go to take a test, because everyone knows what that number is. Say, no thanks, I want another number.
Yeah, I hate to add into this tangent, but I have to add my dose of reality, because that's the business I work in. And, absolutely good advice, absolutely should be done, I agree with you 100%, but I'm a realist, and the reality is, I can tell you firsthand that even if you get assigned a random number, they keep that legacy ID in the computer system. Most computer systems will still keep it in there for the simple ease of use. They'll keep it in there as a backwards reference number. If you go in somewhere and they ask for, let's use a university. Let's use a school or something, for example, that assigns you a random number, a seemingly random number. If you don't remember that number, which most people aren't going to remember this big random number that's assigned to them, you know what the backup number is. You go to the registrar's office to drop or add a class or something like that, or go to pay your tuition or something like that. oh, I don't know what my student number is. I never got that mail, or I don't know, you know what the second question they ask you is. What's your Social Security number? It's not going away, even if you change it.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, I bet I've not heard about anything being brought to court, but I think legally they could be legally compelled to purge that from their system.
I wish they could be, and I would like that. It would be a huge step forward.
Challenge that in court, because I happen to work for an institute of higher learning as well. I do that part time, is where I do my training. And again, most of the people's Social Security numbers are their student numbers. However, so I get a printout of that. I get their name, address, phone number, and Social Security number, which is their student ID. However, when we go to create anything like a username or something for a system, the college policy says you cannot use any more than 3 consecutive numbers from that Social Security number. So people end up doing things like this. First 3 letters of your last name, first 2 letters of your first name, and the last 3 digits of your Social Security number. Because you could recreate that, knowing those parts and pieces of information. But anyway,
right.
I was just getting on that, speaking of personally identifiable information and identity theft and everything.
Yeah, all I'm saying is I've been a database programmer for several years now. I've seen how data is kept, and I can tell you, as a matter of fact, that every place I've ever worked, even when they switched to non-identifiable numbers or gone away from Social Security, they still maintain the Social Security number in the system.
And well, like I say, I think there needs to be a legal challenge to that.
It's one of those things that's going to be a slow revolution. It's got to take place over time. After 5-10 years from now, when they've gotten more comfortable with it, they're not as dependent on Social Security number, then the number will go down and the number will get lower and they will stop asking for it. It's just a slow process.
You know, people were talking about, this kind of goes back to RFIDs, but putting little, like, RFIDs chips inside you like they do for pets when they get lost.
Mm-hmm.
Or get this, a few years ago, because of all the child abductions, they were talking about tattooing the child's Social Security number on their foot at birth.
Oh, you got to be kidding me. I don't want to hear this story anymore.
No, I mean, you know, can you say Auschwitz? You know?
Oh, that's...
Tattooing numbers on their forearms? So that's like... That got shot down really quick.
I'm just disgusted even hearing that.
You may as well just have like a barcode, you know, tattooed on your forehead everywhere you go and just have people read that. But anyway... We're way off topic yet again.
Yeah, you're trying to make me mad now. You've got to be. That couldn't have been a serious. Never mind. I don't even want to know. Anyway, back to Google.
So now, that's not only Gmail. Google has a lot of other services, don't they?
Well, yeah, but unfortunately, I hate to say it, but we're going to have to save those for another show.
Well, let's just mention them briefly.
All right. Well, I don't know. I think if we mention it, we may end up going into it. I'd rather save it for a part three. We're gonna have to make a Google part three.
Dang. Okay. Well.
Is there anything else we wanted? You know what? Actually, as I'm thinking about this here with the Gmail, I'm thinking about I have a Yahoo account, and I noticed a change in my Yahoo account this past week. And I can't help but assume or wonder if it was triggered by, you know, Google and Gmail announcement and stuff that they're worried they decided to make changes because they have this one huge annoyance that several people have complained about, myself included, where their junk mail filter, their spam filter, is horrendous. It's the worst out of... I've tried several different mail accounts, webmail, different free services. It's far and away the worst ever. Phenomenal amount of junk mail that I get to the Yahoo account.
I just logged onto mine here, by the way. I don't know the last time I was on, but there's 1,313 in the bulk message account.
And that, let me tell you, I'll show you the difference right now, and you'll probably notice it. I had pretty much abandoned my account because it just got unmanageable. You have a 6-megabyte limit.
Actually, it's 4. I just read it.
Mine is 6. I'm positive of it.
3 4-megabyte storage, up to twice as much as other free email providers. I'm just reading this right off the screen.
Wow. Maybe because I've had it a long time, they gave me 6 or something, I don't know. I'm definitely 100% positive I have 6. But anyway, I have 6-meg limit, and what happens is anything that goes into your junk mail account, which is what they filtered out as they assume to be junk mail, using their filter, counts towards your limit. It always has counted, and that's one of the things that myself and several people didn't like about it, and I'd finally given up. You know how long it takes to fill my email? 2 days. and 6 megs of junk mail I get in 2 days. And what happens is that fills your mailbox, and any mail coming to you bounces because it's full. It says quota full. So I'd have to go in after a couple days and delete all that stupid junk mail out of it. And it got tired of it, and I said, forget about it. I was just about completely given up on it, and I went into it last week, and now you're seeing yours in front of you, even though you have 1,300 in there, which is a lot. It's not counting all of it towards your disk space.
I've gone back here now, and it's funny that I was reading the one thing where it said 4 meg. Now that I'm actually into the account, it says you're using 9% of your 6 meg limit. So.
Uh-huh.
But even with the 1,300, which was in the bulk folder,
right, it does not count towards it.
Right, it was only 9%.
Yeah, so before it was probably at 99%, and when they made this change, you dropped back to 9 because it doesn't count towards your quota anymore. Hmm. Anyway, who knows what? But I mean, that is the point. It was taking up my email. Was every day I'd come in and say it was full.
Hey, so. Speaking of Yahoo, I got just now that I went back on here. I actually seldom use it for mail. I use a few of the other things in that, but a lot of listeners may know I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and I don't think I've ever put anything in Yahoo's profile to say I live in Phoenix, Arizona, but son of a gun, here's an advertisement for a new subdivision just outside of Phoenix, Arizona. Imagine that. I wonder how they found that out.
How did they know?
How did they figure that out?
I don't know. Anyway, changing that, you know, that's a change for Yahoo that now... You know, if it doesn't count towards me, that thing can fill up all at once. It's taking up their space, not my quota space. So I also wonder if they're going to... Now, Yahoo obviously has advertising, like you just said, but I wonder if they're going to start targeting even more so. I mean, obviously they're targeting your
obviously now, yes, they are.
Yeah, but I wonder if they're going to start targeting via keywords in your messages.
It's entirely possible.
You know what we might... Well, you know what we might have to do? We might have to do a little study. We might have to do some analysis here. Get us some government funding, a couple mil, and start purposely sending messages to each other with certain keywords and see what we can trigger intentionally. See what kind of abuse we can do to their system. We got to get some... They need to hurry up and give us some damn Gmail accounts so we can start playing with them.
Well, would that make us G-men?
Ooh, I think that would.
Government money? Government cheese?
Yeah. Hey, don't knock the government cheese. That's good stuff.
Yeah. Did you have that with your powdered chocolate milk when you were a kid?
No, let me give you, as we close out, this is my tip to everyone. This is my tip from me to you, Stank Dog. This is advice to live with you for the rest of your life. Never mix cheese and chocolate. It's the worst combination ever. I had a cheese sandwich one time, chased it with a chocolate milk. Oh, my God, I will never do that again.
I somehow remember having a chocolate cheese thing one time.
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. It was just like, yikes. Oh, all right. Anyway, yeah. Let's wrap it out here. Here's a couple more quick things. We're over, but we've still got a minute or two left. A couple of things I copied and pasted out of their FAQ and out of their explanations of the system that I thought might be interesting. Email contents and usage. I'll read this very quickly. The contents of your Gmail account are also stored and maintained on Google servers in order to provide the service. Google's computers process the information in your email for various purposes, including formatting and displaying the information to you, delivering targeted related information such as advertisements and related links, preventing unsolicited bulk email spam, backing up your email, and other purposes related to offering you Gmail. Because we keep backup copies of data for the purposes of recovery from errors or system failure, residual copies of email may remain on our systems for some time, even after you have deleted messages from your mailbox or after the termination of your account. I suspect that they keep them forever myself, but Google employees do not access the content of any mailbox unless you specifically request them to do so. For example, if you're having technical difficulties accessing your account, or if it is required by law
3-letter agency
to maintain our system, which is why I wanted to bring this up before we close, or to protect Google here's the last line, this one bothers me too, or to protect Google or the public. And what the hell is protecting the public? What the hell does that mean? Somebody define what is protecting the public.
Preventing terrorism.
Obviously, so...
So all those farmers that are looking for manure and fertilizer, watch out.
They're protecting us from getting a bad cabbage or something from the farmers. And anyway.
Also, I want to throw this out as a last thought here. I looked up the USA Patriot Act. Okay, get this. Uniting and strengthening of America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism. So it has nothing to do with being patriotic. So when people call it the Patriot Act, you're part of the problem. You're not part of the solution. You're empowering those people that pass that, and that's nothing whatsoever to do with patriotism.
That is a cleverly created acronym.
Great marketing.
Yeah, we got a great marketing department in our government, don't we?
Yep.
And let's see. Oh, along the same lines of that thought. It says, quote, under prohibited actions in Google Gmail policies, you cannot, quote, use Gmail to violate the legal rights, such as rights of privacy and publicity of others. I thought that quite a bit ironic.
Yeah.
Very, very ironic. And I mentioned it here in the notes, I don't know if you want to, DoubleClick has been doing this for years, the banner ad people. I mean, this is not new. They've been doing targeted advertising. They've been maintaining cookies on your site that tell where you've been and tracking you and sending you targeted stuff for years and years and years. You know, this is nothing new as far as an idea. It's just Google, of all people, should know better. Or I would have thought they would have known better anyway. Anyway, yes, we're going to have to break this into a part three. Next week I'm going to talk about Google Answers and Google PageRank system. And some details about that, some play-along stuff. This is more fun, you know, some actual hacking hands-on stuff that you can play with. So I apologize, whoever wrote that email earlier, I said we'd be talking about it today. It's obviously going to rack over. So how about we go to the shouts? You got any particular shouts you want to give?
Yeah, shouts to Ed Skotus, if he's listening to this. all the crew out here in PHX.
And even though we are not going to talk about Hack TV today, I have to give shouts to Saito187 for all this work in Hack TV and anybody who helped out with Hack TV. There's a list of credits at the end of that. And I have some long overdue shouts to SciPete from my 2600 meeting. He went and represented us at Tech Galaxy Conference all by himself, last minute thing, and none of us could get away from work to do it. And he went out there and was our representative from our 2600 group. So shouts to him and a lot of other stuff. He's been helping us out a lot lately at DDP and giving us a lot of ideas and submissions to Ben Rev Radio, et cetera. So shouts out to him. And you know what? Shouts out to hackers in South Africa. South freaking Africa. How cool is that?
Yeah.
So shouts there. And email us. radio@benrev.com. Submit your articles. Still waiting. articles@benrev.com.
And by the way, I just finished my BitTorrent download. I had 168K per second, and I just started it when we were talking about it. So
cool.
I now have the full copy of Hack TV, and I will seed that out for the universe.
Yeah, and you actually, you might want to watch that one. There's some minor changes to the preview copy that DDP members got. There was a little bit of rearranging, a little bit of extra intro and outro stuff, so you might want to rewatch it. It's changed a tiny bit from the preliminary.
That's cool.
And our closing music tonight is from a group, Barcelona, and it's called I Have the Password to Your Shell Account. So listen to that. And Rax, thank you again for being on.
Sure, man.
2 weeks in a row. We're going to have to, I don't know, we might have to do a third week in a row of Google, or I don't know if I might split the next episode up to see if I can get Saito, but either way,
else for a change, you know.
What's that?
It'd be nice to talk about something else for a change.
Besides Google.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
Oh no, not, yeah. Not in my universe.
Yeah, exactly. So Google's the center of the internet universe. So until that changes, we'll see you next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.